Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
It's very hard for reporters to just point out that North Korea has never offered to give up nuclear weapons. Instead, it's always, well, the president says this and experts differ.
The president's June summit with North Korea offered some blockbuster coverage. What happened? From WNYC, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Plus, we look back at another moment in our history of nuclear fears, immortalized in the movie The Day After.
This is not an exercise.
Roger, understand. Major Reinhardt, we have a massive attack against the U.S. at this time.
And then we are deploying them as well. And so everyone located near these missile silos is watching them come out of the ground. And to me, in some ways, it's the most haunting images in the film are seeing these missiles going up into the air.
And a playwright ponders how we might remember a Simpsons episode in the months, years, and decades after society's collapse.
It's all coming up after this.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Last week, the Trump administration imposed sanctions on three foreign companies for selling prohibited goods to North Korea. And Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin says they won't be lifted until, quote, the final fully verified denuclearization of North Korea. A few days earlier, National Security Advisor John Bolton had complained about North Korean inaction on the issue.
We're not looking for rhetoric here. We're looking for performance of North Korea's own commitment made to us, made to South Korea beforehand, to denuclearize.
Are you suggesting North Korea is not living up to that commitment?
I'm suggesting President Trump has held the door open for them. They need to walk through it.
So, in a quick recap of recent history, Donald Trump elevated our nuclear fears by calling Kim Jong-un Little Rocket Man and threatening, quote, fire and fury like the world has never seen, then held a summit with Kim that he said pulled the world from the brink of annihilation.
And the president tweeted, after the long flight from Singapore, everybody can now feel much safer than the day I took office. He also added, there is no longer a nuclear threat from North Korea.
The Kim regime replied that the U.S. must first stand down and carried on developing its nuclear weapons and missile program. The standoff has been bizarre and frightening, a sort of real-life black comedy, which is precisely how it looks to Jeffrey Lewis. He's director of the East Asian Non-Proliferation Program at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey and an expert on the nuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Having spent most of the Trump administration being asked where all this could lead, he answers that question in a book titled The 2020 Commission Report on the North Korean Nuclear Attacks Against the United States, which is a novel.
We do a lot of work at my center where we try to explain what the North Koreans are thinking about nuclear weapons and how things might go wrong. And it turns out it's really hard to explain to people how a crazy outcome could actually happen logically. It's very hard to reason someone into an unreasonable outcome. It's much easier to show someone in a story how bad decisions and a bit of bad luck can go wrong.
The premise of the book is just that convergence of events. Routine U.S.-South Korean war games taking place near the Korean DMZ, a provocative U.S. PSYOPs strategy, a technical problem on a South Korean passenger plane, all of these resulting in the North Koreans shooting down that airliner and killing 200-some passengers, most of them teenagers. And then all hell breaks loose.
Yeah, so it's easy enough to imagine a serious crisis, but what really then has to happen is that crisis has to spin somehow out of control. And in the book, the way it spins out of control is leaders trying to make good decisions, but trying to make those good decisions with bad information and sometimes with really bad processes. So I don't, for example, paint President Trump as a malignant force who's trying to start a nuclear war, but all the people around him who are trying to manage up spend all their time managing him and not enough time actually managing the crisis that's spinning out of control.
It all comes off as ripped out of the headlines and just a little bit extrapolated. In other words, it all seems so real.
Well, yeah. One thing I wanted to do is just have real people do real things. And what happens is the context is different. There was a story that the staff struggles to explain the concept of time zones to President Trump. On a day-to-day basis, that's a bit of weird local color. But in the middle of an international crisis, those kinds of things suddenly get really dangerous. So I didn't force anyone to do anything that they don't already do. I just needed to curate the behaviors that we already see and then toss in a little bit of bad luck.
In the book, the crisis takes place right after Trump has just tweet-fired his entire national security team. There's kind of nobody minding the store.
Yeah. Early on, I made the decision to put President Trump down at Mar-a-Lago. I actually dug into the different practices for staffing the president when he's down there. Mar-a-Lago is a private club, and so the staff don't stay there. When you put all that stuff together, the way the president's being handled presents these really obvious plot points for things to go really wrong, for him to tweet when he shouldn't be, for him to get bad information that he shouldn't have, and just generally to be very disruptive.
Now, you said earlier that you don't portray the president in this book as behaving out of malice, but the Donald Trump you write about in this book is an erratic, vain, incurious imbecile, which is just one of many factors contributing to the catastrophe, but not a trivial one.
Even when you have less erratic presidents, there's a lot about our nuclear policy that's a little bit crazy. Trump helps illustrate why certain things, like, for example, giving a president sole authority to launch nuclear weapons without a second vote, maybe isn't the greatest idea.
Some of the risks you identify, it seems to me, reside in people's lack of understanding about North Korean mentality and its history of American nuclear doctrine, of our ability to intercept incoming missiles, and a whole host of other assumptions that many of us simply are getting wrong. What's the top of your list?
I think the big thing that we never quite think about is how our plans interact with their plans. You know, in the book, I describe three different war plans: North Korea's war plan, South Korea's war plan, and the U.S. war plan. And the U.S. war plan actually shares something in common with the other two, which is it totally depends on going first. The problem is, two of them are wrong about that. And I really worry that in a crisis, that could be incredibly escalatory, because I think military officials in all three countries will be pushing their president to get moving before the other side does.
To what extent is the press coverage culpable in our misunderstanding of the situation here?
One big problem is that the North Koreans are never really represented in our coverage. Our coverage is almost always a political horse race. It's Republicans versus Democrats. So the North Koreans are almost like extras in the story, which is not how they are in real life. And then I think the other thing, which is just a structural problem that is true for all reporting at the moment, is what do we do when the president lies? We have seen the Secretary of State and the President of the United States describe what was agreed to in Singapore in terms that are just plainly false. And I think it's very hard for reporters to just point out that North Korea has never offered to give up nuclear weapons. You know, instead, it's always, well, the president says this and experts differ. That leaves open the idea that perhaps the falsehoods that the administration have presented are true, but then leads to this whiplash effect when it turns out North Korea is not giving up the bomb.
May I suggest a possible third area of concern? And that is the characterization of the North Korean regime as fundamentally irrational.
Yeah, I think that we have real trouble separating ruthlessness from irrationality. You know, a lot of the things that Kim Jong-un has done are terrible, right? Assassinating his half-brother or executing his uncle. But those are not instances where he's insane. Those are instances where he, with some reason, believes that there are people who want to push him from power. We don't do a good job of trying to understand how it might be rational in his mindset.
In the beginning of this conversation, I outlined some of the things that have taken place with respect to North Korea and how the two sides seem to be no closer to any kind of ongoing enforceable agreement. What do you think does happen from here?
Well, we're going to continue to see this gap. You know, the North Koreans are not offering to give up their nuclear weapons. What the North Koreans think is that their nuclear weapons have brought the United States to the table, and that if they're willing to entertain the aspiration that someday these weapons won't be needed, that then the United States will move to make relations better. The U.S. has the opposite idea, right? Give up the nuclear weapons first, and then we get better relations. That gap is not bridgeable, right? Someone has to change. And so I think for the foreseeable future, that gap will persist, and the Trump administration is going to try to paper over it. What I worry about is the day when it becomes clear that North Korea isn't giving up its nuclear weapons. What does the Trump administration do? The best option would be to admit that North Korea is not going to give up its nuclear weapons, admit that the threats of 2017 were counterproductive, be realistic, that we're going to have to learn to live at least for a while with North Korea's nuclear weapons, and then work on a totally different basis. That really does not sound like President Trump to me, right? What seems far more likely is that President Trump will turn on Kim Jong-un in the same way he's turned on other world leaders who have disappointed him. And then he'll take the car keys away from Pompeo, and he'll give them to John Bolton, and I think we'll be in for the kind of rough period that I describe at the beginning of my book.
Yeah, and how rough, really? The whole point of your book is that we are just a few coincidental events away from nuclear devastation. Is there anything you can say to reassure me that this is all just a figment of your imagination?
I think the best I can do is say that if you look at past nuclear crises and past close calls, it would be far more frightening than this book. We've been way worse off before, and we've made dumber decisions, and we've always managed to muddle through. So if you think this book is frightening, try going through the historical documents.
Jeffrey, thank you very much.
Happy to be your ray of sunshine.
Jeffrey Lewis is the author of the 2020 Commission Report on the North Korean Nuclear Attacks Against the United States. Coming up, 35 years after the day after.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, Congress has passed a law that will ban TikTok. But why?
If you are going to take away an app used by 170 million people, I believe that lawmakers and the government who ostensibly work for us, the American people, owe us more information about why that divestiture is being moved forward.
Debating the TikTok ban. That's the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. When it comes to nuclear war and grabbing the public's imagination, nothing beats a big show. Take, for instance, the 1953 test blast that was nationally televised from the Nevada desert. The government had set up a mock neighborhood near Yucca Flat dubbed Doomtown, where dummies arranged as American families waited for doom.
To show the nation the effects of atomic blast on homes, home-type shelters, and automobiles.
In 1981, the doomsday clock had been set to 4 minutes to midnight. In 1983, President Reagan was escalating tensions with the Soviet Union.
They preach the supremacy of the state, declare its omnipotence over individual man, and predict its eventual domination of all peoples on the earth. They are the focus of evil in the modern world.
That fall, Soviet aircraft shot down a Korean passenger jet. Then, a system malfunction showed U.S. missiles were launched. A Soviet officer averted disaster by double-checking before retaliating. Then, in November, believing that NATO war exercises were obscuring a real attack, the Soviet Union readied its military for an actual conflict. Then, weeks later, The made-for-TV movie The Day After aired on televisions around the country. An estimated 100 million people, nearly half the nation, tuned in to ABC to watch what a nuclear attack might look like.
What's going on?
Those are Minuteman missiles.
Like a test, sort of. Like a warning?
They're on their way to Russia. They take about 30 minutes to reach their target.
So do theirs, right?
It was affecting television, and ABC knew it. After the movie, the network aired an all-star panel of scientists, pundits, and politicians, all talking about disarmament and deterrence. Ted Koppel hosted.
If you can, take a quick look out the window. It's all still there. Your neighborhood is still there, so is Kansas City, and Lawrence, and Chicago, and Moscow, and San Diego, and Vladivostok. What we have all just seen is sort of a nuclear version of Charles Dickens' Christmas Carol.
The Day After managed to catalyze a national conversation about American nuclear policy, but that didn't make it a good movie.
And more than that, it was not intended to be a very good movie.
The director, Nicholas Meyer, was interviewed on the Outline World Dispatch podcast last year.
I just thought, no, it can't be a good movie. It has to be like a public service announcement. If you have a nuclear war, this is more or less what it's going to be like.
Faced with a nation of families uncertain about how to explain nuclear war to their kids, Mr. Rogers aired a five-part series on dealing with conflict.
There are other ways to solve a problem. There are other ways to solve a nasty problem. Other ways.
Back then, Marcia Gordon was in junior high. She well remembers the fear and the fervor. She's now a professor of film studies at North Carolina State University, and we spoke to her earlier this year when she'd just written about The Day After for the website The Conversation.
There's basically a before and then the day after. And so you have normal Midwestern people getting married, people having babies, people going about their lives.
No! Where have you two been?
Hi, Mom.
Sorry, Miss Dolberg.
Hi, Riverwalkers.
And then all of a sudden, this scenario unfurls.
We just hit one of our ships in the Persian Gulf.
What's
this? The Russians, who do you think? We hit them back, one of their ships, you know?
And people are panicked as the alarm goes out that there's incoming nuclear missiles.
Roger, copy. This is not an exercise.
Roger, understand. Major Reinhardt, we have a massive attack against the U.S. net at this time. ICBMs.
And then we are deploying them as well. And so everyone located near these missile silos is watching them come out of the ground. And to me, in some ways, it's the most haunting images in the film are seeing these missiles going up into the air and people looking at them.
Danny!
ABC decided not to run advertisements after the blast. It just played through.
What we see in the aftermath is there's no electricity, but plenty of radiation and a lot of expositional scenes where the full magnitude of all of this sets in. Here's a clip from a hospital.
Now, what about fuel to boil water, heat food, sterilize surgical instruments?
What about bringing in wood?
You can't burn wood that's been contaminated. Just put radiation right back in the air. What about bottled gas?
There's some butane, but no more than about 3 days' worth.
All of the action is on the local level. It is the farmers, the doctors, the people on the ground have the sense and have the ability to navigate this crisis in a way that the government does not.
Can you explain what you mean by scraping off the top layers of my topsoil?
Exactly that, Jim. You just take the top 4 or 5 inches of your topsoil.
Yeah, and do what with it? We're talking 150, maybe 200 acres a man in here.
That's right.
Being big is one thing, being realistic is another. Suppose you find a hole where you can drop all this dead dirt. What kind of topsoil is that going to leave you for raising anything? Where'd you get all this information, John? All this good advice out of some government pamphlet?
And there is even a presidential broadcast over the shortwave radio.
There has been no surrender, no retreat from the principles of liberty and democracy for which the free world looks to us for leadership. The government, functioning under certain extraordinary emergency options, We are prepared to make every effort.
And to drive the point home, we see people stumbling through the rubble as he's talking, and some who are huddled over the radio have this reaction.
That's it? That's all he's going to say?
Hey, maybe we're going to be okay.
What do you want to hear?
I want to know who started it, who fired first, who preempted.
You're never going to know that.
What difference does it make?
He doesn't know how badly we were
hit. He sure would have told us if they would have fired first.
He doesn't want anyone to think we lost the war.
You believe that?
After the broadcast, there was a panel hosted by Ted Koppel. It had the great astronomer Carl Sagan and Elie Wiesel, known for his writings about the Holocaust and hunting Nazis. George Shultz from Reagan's defense team.
It's a discussion of contemporary America's nuclear strategy and also of the Soviet Union. And some of the questions from the audience point to where we are today.
What are we to do 20 to 25 years from now when the superpowers no longer have the decision-making power about whether nuclear war will or will not occur? What about a Khomeini or a Gaddafi having that capability?
And actually, over and over again, Wiesel says things that are very powerful and very timely.
I'm afraid of madness. I'm afraid that madness is possible in history. And the only way, I believe, to prevent that madness would be to remember. If we remember that things are possible, then I believe memory can become a shield.
We live in a world currently where I think that idea really resonates.
And yet, the New York Times ran a story before the broadcast, quoting a therapist, urging families not to watch the post-show panel discussion hosted by Ted Koppel. Quote, it's extremely important for people to talk about the day after themselves and not let television do the talking and feeling for them. If they do that, they'll lock feelings of despair and fatalism inside themselves.
Well, I have read a number of articles that came out just before this airing in which psychologists express actual long-term concerns about young people watching this program that ranged from bedwetting and nail biting to insomnia. A lot of people did not think that people under the age of 12, for example, should maybe watch this at all.
And there were viewing guides that were distributed to guide conversation. We have a link to it on our website. Here's a sample question. Of all the institutions which presently constitute American society, which ones would be best suited to handle a post-war society and its manifold problems?
Yeah, so ABC apparently produced around 500,000 of these study guides and distributed them to schools and churches and community centers. And, you know, on the one hand, clearly they were trying to promote viewership. It was also, I think, to forestall criticism that they were just putting this terrifying movie out in the world and letting people fend for themselves with how to deal with it. The study guide does, though, ask some really good questions about how people thought about the likelihood of this happening, about its survivability, the political context and consequences, which was certainly on everyone's mind. It just, I don't think, had been thought of in such a big pop cultural way that didn't reach so many people.
As you wrote in your piece, the movie was used as a rallying cry both for the anti-nuclear groups and the pro ones.
It's interesting to see the way that Reagan's White House responded to this film by trying to turn it into a film that advocates for nuclear deterrence because we don't want this to happen.
And by nuclear deterrence, you mean deterring nuclear war by having a lot of nukes.
Absolutely. And so that was their position. There were protests immediately after this viewing. And of course, there were many people who were anti-nukes and wanted to go into a period of incredible disarmament.
Interestingly, one person who seems to have gotten that message was Ronald Reagan. Not long after the film, Reagan held a series of summits with Mikhail Gorbachev about both countries' nuclear arsenals.
Well, if you listen to that viewpoint discussion after the airing of The Day After, this is discussed, including by Secretary of State Shultz, that the goal was not just to proliferate, that the goal was to get to a point where both countries would agree to start dialing back their nuclear storehouses. And Carl Sagan talks about this idea that you imagine two people in a room.
A room awash in gasoline. And there are two implacable enemies. One of them has 9,000 matches. The other has 7,000 matches. Each of them is concerned about who's ahead, who's stronger. Well, that's the kind of situation we are actually in.
You know, we posted your piece on our On the Media Facebook page, and a listener, Wayne in Hawaii, wrote that he's in his 40s and he saw the film as a child, and quote, "A few weeks ago, when the false missile alert went off in Hawaii, I distinctly remember thinking, well, it finally happened. It wasn't panic. It wasn't fear. It was more resignation than anything else. I think because we were the last generation that grew up during the Cold War, that nuclear annihilation was always a possibility, and it permeated the culture, especially with depictions like The Day After. That anxiety was always there, and it never left us."
Wayne is absolutely right. I don't think that people who are in their 30s and younger have a sense of the fear. There's a big difference between hearing rhetoric like we've heard in the first few weeks of 2018 and imagining what this would look like. I think we might be due for another dose of this.
So how would you remake it today?
I would definitely think about a kind of global context that was not just focused on American soil, but on the many places in which this attack would likely transpire. The question of the technological meltdown is incredibly relevant, and maybe the most relevant in an odd way, especially if you wanted to resonate with young people.
You mean their iPhones won't work anymore?
Yes. If you've never read a map, if you've never figured out how to do anything without consulting technology, how are you going to navigate a world in which technology is no longer functional? And so who is going to have that wisdom? And it's going to be older people who know how to get a shortwave radio to work, know how to get from point A to point B by looking at a map, for example. You could also begin to imagine a scenario in which class gets turned on its head a little bit. I mean, who knows how to weld? Who knows how to hunt? I mean, is it someone in Silicon Valley who's made their millions off of technology? Or is it somebody who's been having to work in a kind of blue-collar job? Another thing I would think about is, you know, when I've kind of rolled this over in my mind, the fact that The Day After takes place in such an immediate time post-blast, I think it would be very interesting to think a kind of longer game, like the year after.
Mm-hmm. And then 7 years after, and then 75 years after?
Yeah, right. I mean, what are the long-term consequences? I mean, the idea of a nuclear winter is not approached at all in The Day After, but what if it was never warm enough to germinate a seed? How are you going to survive?
Thank you very much.
You are very welcome.
Marcia Gordon is a professor of film studies at North Carolina State University. She recently wrote about The Day After for the website The Conversation.
Coming up, the stories we tell ourselves after the disaster.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The Day After imagines a world reeling from nuclear attack. Marcia Gordon says she'd like to see a piece that reflects on the long-term impact of apocalypse. Playwright Anne Washburn tackled one aspect of that in her 2012 play, Mr. Burns, a post-electric play. And we spoke to her in February. It depicts a world devastated by a nuclear incident of some kind in which the survivors cope by retelling one episode of The Simpsons.
You got a letter too, Bart. I'm going to kill you.
I was really curious to see what would happen to a story over time under kind of extreme conditions.
And the story that you chose to follow across the decades is an episode from The Simpsons called Cape Fear.
It's the Simpsons version of the Scorsese remake of the Robert Mitchum original, which was itself based on a novel. In the episode, Bart was involved in putting Sideshow Bob away to prison for his various incredible misdeeds. And Sideshow Bob is sending him death threats.
If released, would you pose any threat to one Bart Simpson?
Bart Simpson? The spirited little scamp who twice foiled my evil schemes and sent me to this dank, urine-soaked hellhole.
And finally, the family, to sort of escape him, goes away on a houseboat in the middle of a river.
Don't worry, Mrs. Simpson. We've helped hundreds of people in danger.
We have places your family can hide in peace and security. Cape Fear, Terror Lake, New Horror Field, Screamville.
Ooh, Ice Creamville.
No, Screamville.
And of course, Sideshow Bob shows up again, and there's a kind of a duel to the death, which gets very involved with Gilbert and Sullivan.
Well, Bart, any last requests?
You have such a beautiful voice.
Guilty as charged.
I was wondering if you could sing the entire score of the HMS Pinafore.
Very well, Bart. I shall send you to heaven before I send you to hell.
And there's a climactic scene on the river with the performance of HMS Pinafore.
What never, no never, what never, hardly ever, ever, he's hardly ever sick.
And finally, Bart is saved when the ship runs aground next to a
brothel. And a whole bunch of police,
they come streaming out and eventually decide to arrest him.
So now let's turn to your work. Mr. Burns, a post-electric play, Act 1, Scene 1.
We open on a group of people around a campfire, and they're really trying very hard to remember this episode of The Simpsons.
Sideshow Bob takes Bart out of the hole and onto the deck and the crocodile.
And I think it seems at first very much like an activity which is very familiar to us. All of us at one point or another been in a group of people trying to put together a TV episode and sort of enjoying it and laughing at it and relaxing with it.
Homer's like, hey, everybody, walk and drive through that tacky patch. And they're like, yay!
And it's only as the play kind of moves forward and we hear a sort of strange noise in the shrubbery and everyone stops what they're doing, pulls out guns, that we realize the stakes are different.
And the person who emerges from the woods is a guy named Gibson, who describes his path to this campsite. And so we're able to piece together that essentially the world is in flames. You kind of infer that this is probably a string of terrible nuclear incidents. All we know is that now people, they're basically in survival mode.
Mm-hmm.
How does Act One end?
After much sort of struggle to integrate Gibson into the group, they start to retell the Simpsons episode. And there are numerous Gilbert and Sullivan quotations in that episode of The Simpsons. And Gibson, as it turns out, was a member of his local Gilbert and Sullivan Society. So he has that information.
Say words, never, never, never get sick at sea. I'm never, never sick at sea. What never, no never, what never, well, hardly ever. He's hardly ever sick at sea.
Yes. There's a little parenthetical in the stage directions. Please note that these are people who in normal life would never be interested in the introduction of more Gilbert and Sullivan into their immediate social environment. But in the context, they're thrilled. So he joins in, he's able to contribute to the group, and they all kind of join in and merrily sing as the lights sort of sweetly go out on this scene at the end of Act One.
And then Act Two begins. It's 7 years later. The Simpsons episode is still being told, but it's no longer a campfire tale.
So that same group of people plus a new member have become... they've become a roving Simpsons troupe, and they will retell and recreate as best they can episodes from The Simpsons, one of which is Cape Fear.
At last, Bart Simpson, at last, while you and your family cozy yourselves away in this houseboat.
We sort of discover they're one of a number of groups which are doing similar things. There are other Simpsons groups. They also make reference to the medical drama group. I think there's an ER or house. The landscape is sort of littered with these troops who are handling TV shows of the past. There is reference made to the Shakespeares. There's a group doing Shakespeare, but it seems pretty clear that that's the most low-rent group you could fall into, and only if you are really diseased and desperate.
But the thing is, they are treating these works as unchangeable relics of the past.
It's 7 years after the apocalyptic event wherein our civilization was destroyed. And 7 years is not a long period of time. And it really seemed to me that 7 years after the apocalypse, people are going to want what's certain, what's reassuring, what reminds them very solidly of the old time. So the value for entertainment at that time is not going to be in creative expression or commentary on the moment. The value is going to be on the troop which can pull together the most exacting replica of a cartoon possible.
No motivation, no consequence. That's the point of a cartoon. Where else do we get to experience that?
Does that mean that these roving troops never really comment on their lives as they live it?
I think they don't comment at all during the episodes, but the episode does have commercial breaks. And I feel like the commercials are where you would have latitude. There are two commercials that we see in the second act. And one of them is a woman comes home from a long, tedious day at the office. You know, she takes off her earrings, she checks her purse, she removes her shoes. She makes sort of exasperated noises. Her husband is sympathetic. She's like, oh, you should take a bath. She's like, I'll take a bath. Can I get you a Chablis? Yes, I'd love a Chablis.
Better.
A little.
And as she's preparing the bath, she's talking about someone at work who's stealing lunch bags out of the office refrigerator, which is all sort of careless and merry, but there is no way in that kind of future that anyone would appreciate someone going up on stage and saying, oh my God, we can be looted or raped or robbed at any moment, and there's very little to prevent anyone from doing it. That's not going to be a welcome commentary, but there is kind of nostalgia, A, for a time when somebody snitching lunches out of the office refrigerator was the worst thing that might happen to you in a day. But also there is this sense, I think, in which this weird roving figure who steals mysteriously and no one can seem to control is the very lighthearted shadow of something which would be of a concern at the time.
Menace looming behind you. You just don't see it except maybe out of the corner of your eye.
Yes, in this case embodied in the jerk who's stealing lunches out of the refrigerator with seemingly no moral compass whatsoever.
Like Sideshow Bob.
Like Sideshow Bob. I mean, that story, that original story, that Cape Fear story is so wonderful because the Robert Mitchum character who becomes the De Niro character who becomes Sideshow Bob is just pitiless and he's remorseless.
So now to your third act. It is 75 years later. And the acting out of the Simpson episodes, especially this one, Cape Fear, seems to have become a massive production, a cultural touchstone like Faust, maybe.
I'm here to report an incident at the Springfield Nuclear Power Plant.
That Flanders sees his cross.
Because God is always handy.
Fight, and fight.
The birds are calling for the dawn. On the horizon.
75 years later, it's become a kind of crazy, gaudy melodrama, which is really about violence and it's about contamination. And Sideshow Bob has morphed into Mr. Burns, who in the series is the nuclear power plant owner. But he's become that same kind of hideous, inexorable threat, completely poisonous, completely toxic.
Except that Sideshow Bob is, you know, vain and vanquished. And it seems like Mr. Burns is invincible.
This is it, Burns. You're never coming back.
What? Never?
No, never.
What? Never? Kill me now, Bart Simpson. Kill me all you like, but don't be surprised when you and I meet again. I'm never leaving.
You can't stop him. I mean, in the first act, no one knows what's going on particularly. The characters are very much dealing with rumor. You know, like, how far does contamination go? Does the wind spread? You know, where do you need to be safe? And no one knows. No one knows where it's safe, which people both speak about in short bursts and mostly try not to speak about and try not to think about, because why would you? It would be crazy making. And in the second act, there's a kind of a speech where one of the characters talks about the contamination that no one has any idea of, you know, from chemical plants. You know, a tank dissolves or it explodes and it's by a river or it's on an aquifer. So second act is a little bit haunted by this sense of contamination which is not understood and not possible to do anything about. And so in the third act, you do see this character who really sort of takes that on.
Mr. Burns.
Mr. Burns, who just is just the force which cannot be stopped, cannot be reckoned with, cannot be vanquished. There is a sort of a happy ending, but it doesn't come about because Bart is smart or is brave. The hand of God does not intervene. He only succeeds because he manages to just cussedly hang on long enough for events to change in his favor. But there's no sense in the third act that virtue is rewarded. If you survived, it's because you somehow held on. And
it's a function of luck.
It's a function of luck.
Why The Simpsons?
It was not a Simpsons-specific idea originally. I had sort of thought Seinfeld or Friends or Cheers or any program which was cheerful, which a lot of people had known. And I don't remember how I arrived at The Simpsons. It turns out to work really well, partly, I think, because it's been around for so long.
Mm-hmm.
And also because it's a cartoon, it has so many characters and it's such a huge, wide world. I think also that a lot of sort of the big popular comedies are about friend groups and intentionally formed communities. And The Simpsons is very much about the family you're stuck with and the community you're stuck with and how you make the best of it, which I think would be more resonant in a post-apocalyptic world. I mean, people would be longing for the families that were gone. They would be struggling with issues of how you create a community which isn't completely dysfunctional.
It's funny, when we spoke to Marcia Gordon about The Day After, even though it had a huge impact, there hasn't been a big effort to show it again. And yet, your play has been produced year after year after year since it debuted. Does it feel different now? Does it resonate differently?
Only in the sense that I think the question of nuclear annihilation just feels a little more present in our culture right now. It isn't about a nuclear war and the result. It is about nuclear. I mean, Burns is not a PSA, almost to my regret. I have many bossy opinions on the topic of what it is for humans to handle a technology they actually are demonstrably unable to control. Nuclear power is completely safe as long as there is no human failure of any kind, no infrastructure failure of any kind. It's completely safe as long as it is controlled by a civilization which progresses continuously with, you know, smooth segues from one civilization to the next for a period of about 10,000 years. And that's something which has never happened in the history of human beings. There are disruptions and there are wars. And under those conditions, nuclear power with its intense dependence for safety on an incredibly vulnerable electrical grid is not completely safe. So that was a source of tension which drove the making of the play.
There is something exciting about the breakdown of systems, though, isn't there? Something liberating about that?
I think it's immensely soothing to think about the apocalypse because it's the point where there's no use being anxious about the apocalypse. You know, you can move on to new, more concrete problems. The suspense is over.
It was a pleasure talking to you.
It was a real pleasure talking with you. Thank you.
Anne Washburn is a playwright, and the play we've discussed is Mr. Burns, a post-electric play. The excerpts featured in this segment were pulled primarily from a 2017 production by Amherst Regional High School. Lately, our apocalyptic fears have sprung from itchy Twitter fingers and rhetoric of fire and fury. But it was not so long ago, 7 years in fact, that a group of journalists got together to consider the end of the world, and the nuclear option was not the calamity of choice. It didn't even come in second place. A journalism powwow held in 2011, attended by heavy hitters like Google, the New York Times, and the Knight Foundation, featured freewheeling discussions of topics like, you know, present and future business models to monetize the news industry. But the loosely scheduled so-called unconference also featured a whiteboard where anyone could post a topic. At the time, Andrew Fitzgerald was at Twitter. He's now at Hearst. And he suggested a session on reporting the apocalypse. He told us back then that the group settled on two scenarios: global pandemic and alien invasion. Fitzgerald said the idea came to him after all that talk about the future of news.
I was standing there looking at the whiteboard myself, and I thought, but what about the real future? What about the end of time? And so just walked up to the whiteboard myself and put down reporting the end of the world. And we sat there and discussed best practices and tips and tricks for reporting during the apocalypse.
You wrote in your blog post, you wake up on a Tuesday, make yourself some coffee, open your laptop, check Twitter to find spaceships are suspended over our planet's major cities, preparing to attack. So how did you think things would play out from there?
Well, we borrowed the scenario, admittedly, from Independence Day, which I am a secret fan of.
And you will once again be fighting for our freedom, not from tyranny, oppression, or persecution, but from annihilation. And should we win the day, the 4th of July will no longer be known as an American holiday, but as the day when the world declared in one voice, we will not go quietly into the night. We will not vanish without a fight.
That model of the aliens appear, there is a short period of time before they begin any sort of action. And so you have a period of time of spreading information in which our communications infrastructures are still working.
A lot of the technology is going to be the first thing to go. No internet, maybe no phone communications, or at least cell phones. So how do you even begin as a journalist to get the information out?
Right. The first things Lorg, the alien lord, wants to do is eliminate human ability to communicate. We are incredibly reliant on the technologies that we use on a daily basis. We are not very prepared for those technologies to not be there. Human communication has this rich history of different formats, everything from carrier pigeons to smoke signals to ham radio. But we don't have a lot of experience in, say, ham radios, which is the format we decided would be probably the best one to use. You could probably fit a tweet around a pigeon's leg.
So, but seriously, how are you a journalist in the classic sense during an alien invasion? What would you cover?
When the aliens invade, the first thing that you need to do is do some service journalism. Report where they're moving, what they're up to. You need to explain alien anatomy such that people know that what looks like an alien's hand is actually its mouth, and so you don't want to move your delicious human guts anywhere near that appendage.
So what was the reaction among your journalism cohort when someone raised the idea that perhaps journalists ought to engage in getting the aliens' side of things?
There's a fair amount of shouting down. First, we talked about which celebrity journalist would be first to interview Lorg the Alien Lord, full well knowing that there was a high percentage chance of them not surviving the interview.
Geraldo Rivera.
No names. Very quickly, we started talking about the political reporting on people who thought we should listen to the aliens versus people who didn't think we should start listening to the aliens.
Did it break down along party lines?
I believe the phrase was alien-hugging Democrats versus alien-killing Republicans.
Now, you note that David Carr, the media columnist for the New York Times, observed at the UN-conference that in conflict journalism, it's the symmetries of war that keep journalists safe and that there's no symmetry in our war with our would-be destroyers. What does that mean?
The fact that these two sides are warriors battling with one another. As a journalist, you are in a separate role that is not a part of that symmetrical relationship. And so it is the battle between these two sides that protects you. Unfortunately, in alien conflict, it is the ultimate asymmetry in warfare, the ultimate other.
Well, every single war ever fought has involved the home team and the other with a capital O. That's why war after war, you always hear about the other killing babies. Most of these stories are made up, but they keep reappearing so that they seem less than human. They don't value life the way that we do.
And maybe we would learn this in the sit-down one-on-one with Zlorg, in which we talk about, you know, his upbringing. Maybe they value life more, and maybe they have a reason why humanity must be eradicated that we should listen to.
Let's go to the global pandemic scenario. You wrote, The aliens left us miraculously alone, disappeared into the far reaches of space, and everyone won Pulitzers for their coverage of Invasion Watch 2012. But then you wake up on a Tuesday. Tuesday seems to be a bad day in your scenarios. Make yourself some coffee, open your laptop, and check Twitter to see reports of a fast-moving fatal illness sweeping the planet. And a big discussion around the possible pandemic was whether it'd be okay to suspend the facts. What did you mean by that?
I wanted to raise the question of whether or not one should not wait for verification and put information out there and give it a rating. Say, we don't really believe this is true. We give it a 3 on our pandemic watch truth scale. The journalists in the room roundly disagreed with this idea. Everyone raised the point that actually, in these disaster scenarios, facts are even more important. The example that really resonated with a lot of people in the room was Katrina. The rumors that propagated during those first couple of days, many of which turned out to be absolutely untrue, were widely reported in mass media. We decided that for journalists, in a time of apocalypse, the facts are actually even more important.
So you considered the world ending in alien invasion and the world ending in a pandemic. I'm surprised you didn't consider a scenario which many futurists believe in, that the robots will eventually take over.
It was our planned third apocalypse to go through.
So let's say it really happened. Which would you prefer, to be devoured by aliens or killed in a global pandemic?
You know, I think I would probably choose alien invasion, if for no other reason than at the very end to know that we weren't alone in the universe.
Good answer. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you so much.
Andrew Fitzgerald was at Twitter when we spoke to him back in 2011. He's now with Hearst.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Lowinger, Leah Fetter, and John Hanrahan. We had more help from Asta Chaturvedi, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Sam Baer.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.